It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 444 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week it's another great Kickstarter doubleheader, and it all launches with the return of Russell Brettholz, the creator of Sidekicked, and I always like to point out there's a hyphen between side and kicked. The latest chapter is coming, and that's number 6, and it's doing very well on Kickstarter, but it can always use your support. It's the story of heroes and sidekicks who are now learning to work together during an alien invasion. We catch up on some of the things that are going on in this issue and follow up on some of the things that we've discussed before. Then everything wraps up with my fun conversation with Rob Stanley, who has a Kickstarter going on right now for The Bite of Brenna Barlow. This project has already reached its goal, and he's moving into stretch goals. So we discuss what the book's about, as well as things that could be coming our way in the future from him. This is described as the heartwarming tale of a telepathic blind vampire and her sarcastic dachshund. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say too, and his support of other indie projects as well. A word of warning, we had to record Rob's interview over Skype, and there was some interference while we were doing that. But if you turn up the volume a little bit more, you'll get to hear all the good things Rob has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's always great to talk with Russell Brettholz, the creative force behind Sidekicked. Has I got the title right? What was the title exactly?
It's Sidekicked. It was originally Sidekicks when I launched it on Kickstarter initially back in 2014. But since then, it was picked up by Darby Pop Publishing, and they felt that Sidekicks was just a little too close to J. Michael Straczynski's Sidekick, which was coming out around the same time. So they asked me to change it. So we changed it to Sidekicked, which honestly is a much better title. So it really worked out well, I think.
Very cool, because I have loved this book from the very first time I've seen it. I've always been enamored with Sidekicks, as we've talked about before, and we may cover some of the same ground again a little, but there's updates we know we need to get into when we get to number 6. Now, first thing, of course, and most important, you're 70% there, and I think that's a great accomplishment.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited. You know, we're just today, actually, we're 1 week in and we just hit the 70% mark. So we're exactly where I'd like to be, just cruising along and now doing, you know, podcasts like yours and a couple of other interviews. So I'm feeling really good about it.
Good, good. Because the thing about Kickstarters, of course, you always want to get the goal as quick as you can, because then you don't have to keep checking day after day and going, have I got the heart attack today? Has nobody gone in and helped?
So, yeah, I have to set rules for myself. You know, no more than once per hour. You know, otherwise you go mad.
You get refresh. I've done that with like eBay stuff where I'm selling something or buying something. I'm always looking and looking. So I have to be careful with that stuff. I can relate.
Yeah, it becomes like a monkey on your back. You know, hey, maybe you should go check it. Who knows what's happened since? Going to sleep is the best thing, because it's, you know, eight uninterrupted hours of not having to check the Kickstarter page.
That's funny, because a lot of the stuff I do, I'm doing from home these days, and I never turn it off. You know, 2 a.m. I'm up and I'm not sleepy. I want to get back in the computer and keep working on stuff.
So. Yeah, the being home all the time has definitely been a challenge, because I can work from home, thankfully. And I've been doing that since about mid-March, which it was difficult. I have two kids that are both in school, so it was a little tricky trying to navigate that. But now that school is done, I can really focus on my work during the day, and then focus on my writing during the night and playing with the kids intermittently. So
cool. Very good. Very good. Now, the thing we need to talk about is, you were telling me just before we started to record that you have pretty much got the art complete. And that's another accomplishment there for you. How did that feel? Did you have to plan ahead to get that to happen?
It was less planning and just more having the money for it. Because historically, I just don't have the $4,000 to $5,000 that I need to pay my artists to put out an issue. But because this is now the sixth issue, I have been doing comic conventions for the past 5 years and selling the trade paperback, which collects issues 1 through 4. Last year, around this time, I did a Kickstarter for issue 5. So I was able to build a bit of a war chest so I could get ahead of the artwork in terms of paying my artists. So thankfully, this time around, for the first time, for one of my Kickstarters, the artwork is completely done, which is just, it feels good, because I know I can deliver the digital rewards the instant the Kickstarter campaign is over. And as far as printing, I can get the pages right out to the printer. And I'm using Comic Impressions, which I used for the last issue, and they did a phenomenal job and a very fast turnaround. So I know I'll be able to get the physical issues into people's hands very quickly as well, which is just so great, because I remember back to the first issue, and we only had 4 pages done going into the Kickstarter. So we had another 18 to completely draw. And my co-creator and artist, Miguel Mendoza, wound up breaking his arm right before he was about to go work on the rest of the pages. And that set us back so much. But so being able to have the book finished now is just such a relief.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's great for those of us who are fans and looking forward to seeing it. So we know it's not a long wait and stuff. And luckily for me, I've been able to look at a preliminary copy. So I've gotten to read some of it. We're going to talk some, of course, that I won't spoil major stuff. But there's some things in here that you and I have talked about before, and you've brought to fruition, like in this book. And just fascinating stuff. Of course, like I was saying, I love your writing. I know it's tough to write a comic and have a full-time profession as well. But whenever you've got a book ready, I'm ready for it.
Thank you.
It's good stuff. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you and I have discussed in the past. One of the things I noticed in the early issues, and you mentioned you were going to change some, was a female presence in the comics. Talk a little bit about that, because we get to see more women and girls in this book, and I think you do a great job with them too. I really enjoy I was mentioning to you before, there's an initial sequence where a guy and a girl are involved. Very fanish and very true life. I just really like it. So talk about that. What did it take like for you to get into all this and get this stuff all sorted out to do that so well?
Sure. So there really was a very noticeable absence of women, particularly among the superheroes, in the first 4 issues of the series. And I take that responsibility 100% upon myself. You know, I'm a white heterosexual male, and I write what I know. And that is, for the most part, other white heterosexual males. I was able to have more demographics represented in the book among the sidekicks and the heroes, just because it really made sense for the story. And I think we've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. But as when it came to the women, I just couldn't find a good way to really include them without it feeling false to the story that I was trying to tell. And also because the world of Sidekicked is a bit of a deconstruction and a bit of a satire and a bit of a commentary on superhero comic books in general. And because there really is a poor ratio of women to men in those books, I liked approaching it from the idea of, no, the absence of the women in the book is the commentary itself. So that's how I was able to get through the first four issues. And I also mention in those issues that towards the end, when the Sidekicks finally start to fight back and come and stop their strike, the women all get together, the women Sidekicks, and they leave. They say, look, we don't need the men telling us what to do. And they stake out, you know, the north side of Chicago and say, look, this is our territory. We'll take care of it ourselves. You boys go ahead and do your own thing and leave us alone. So I felt that was a fair way of handling that situation in the first four issues of the series. But I knew in the next arc, which is eventually going to be a five issue arc, I knew I needed to bring the women back into it. And it was really nice to be able to do that finally in chapter six, which is the current issue, where, as you said, Al, who is Jolt, who's one of the main Sidekicks, he has a girlfriend that he met at his part-time job at Burger World. And Sam, when she finds out that Al is this superhero, just completely fangirls on him, which was a lot of fun to write. And to using, you know, that voice of, you know, what would it be like to discover that your partner is a superhero? But also, she's just one aspect of the women in the books. And then, of course, on the flip side are the actual heroes, the former Sidekicks, who happen to be women. And when I introduce Mousseline, who I reference but don't show, and I think it was the fourth issue, she has this grand entrance where she stops a bad guy that the guys were trying to stop, and basically just takes over the scene immediately. You know, the incident happens, it's on a page turn, it's like, bam, there she is. And you know, this is not somebody you want to mess with. And so it was nice to be able to introduce the women superheroes of this world in such a way.
Now, I got to ask, though, because, you know, as you mentioned, it wasn't your initial ability to portray women in the way that you wanted to, or I'm very realistic. How did you approach that? I mean, did you put women that you know as the characters? How did you go ahead and get their voices the way that they were so realistic?
I asked myself, you know, how realistically, you know, there's a lot going on in the world, and, you know, if you're watching, you know, any of the news cycle, we lived through the Me Too movement, and I think that was actually a big part of the voice that I was looking for the women in this book. You know, not so much the harassment aspect of it, but just elevating female voices on the page. So I really wanted to take a realistic approach to it. And since I had already said, okay, the women got together and staked out their own territory, what would they be like? You know, and so I gave them a little bit of this militant feminism. I gave them as much strength as I would any of the male characters. And mostly it was confidence. You know, I said, these women are going to be some of the most confident people in the book. And so that was the place where I started, when in terms of their actions and in terms of their dialogue, was there's not going to be any timidity. There's not going to be any second guessing. It's no. This bad guy has crossed into our territory. He's the sisterhood's problem now. And that's the name that I give the five women who've banded together and one of whom was actually one of the former heroes at Atalanta. So it's really four former sidekicks and this one hero, but Mousseline is the leader. And I always saw her as like a female Wolverine. If Wolverine led the X-Men, but I know there's actually a couple of titles where he's done that. But when I grew up, Wolverine never wanted to be the leader of the X-Men. So right. that was my approach was, okay, here is this, confident, powerful woman, and they have staked out their own part of Chicago, and they are not going to allow the men to tell them what to do or to interfere with what they've got going on.
Well, it's so well done. I mean, they speak with a very realistic voice, and they're different. Not all the women are the same. It's the old John Byrne-ism where women were ugly men, the way that he drew them. And it's a lot of people who are creators don't necessarily handle female characters really well. But I thought you gave them very realistic voices and very strong and different personalities, and that was something I really enjoyed. We have not yet begun to plumb women characters in the comics. I think males we have done for decades, as I like to say. But women, there's a lot of depth that we haven't even started to scratch or get to yet. But I think your book really does a good job of addressing that.
Yeah, thank you. I have the benefit of having a lot of strong women in my social network. I'm in a summer role-playing group. There's seven of us, and it's, four men, three women. So they have their very distinct voices, and it's actually a superhero campaign now that I think about it. So I wouldn't say that I was using any one of their voices in the script for Sidekicked, but just being around them, that's something that I wish I could remember who it was that said it, but if you want to learn how, if you're writing for teenagers, go to the mall and listen to how teenagers speak. So if you're writing strong female characters, surround yourself with strong women so you can hear how they speak, I think is really the lesson there. And it's something that I'm fortunate enough to just have as part of my network. I don't need to go out of my way to do it. And I think that's maybe part of the reason why some of the more mainstream comic books do have that problem with getting the female voice correct, is because it's a lot of people like me who are just straight white males who don't necessarily have those strong women in their lives that they can hear how they talk and therefore replicate that on the page.
Because I always hear from women that men write women as if they were men with female appendages. And I could name a couple, but I won't. But I was so happy with the way you did it. And the diversity of them was just such a good thing to read. And, it's the same as with the guys. The guys are very different from each other. And that's always fun. You've got, speaking of diversity, characters of all different colors and stripes in there. And it's really great to read that. But I guess from Chicago, you're kind of used to that. I'm from a smaller town, and I don't necessarily have that history. When I got to college, I suddenly did. But when I was growing up, in high school and even below that, I was not. And so it was a real learning curve when I got to college. But for you, I guess this is kind of just natural to do it that way.
It was organic in that it helped the story. I knew I could not have a book of just a bunch of white dudes. Like, I knew going into it that was never going to fly. So I asked myself, all right, so I don't want it to feel forced. I don't want to have token minority characters. So if I'm not going to have just white people, how can it benefit the story as well as serving for representation? So, with Walter, who is the assistant editor at the newspaper in Chicago, you know, that it made so much sense for that character to be black and to offer that kind of voice and to have the arguments, the social justice arguments that he's having and the civil rights arguments that he's having with the editor at the paper there, who's a J. Jonah Jameson type. You know, it made so much sense. And in the backstory that I created for him, you know, his parents are both lawyers, and that's where he learned, you know, the sense of justice that he brings to the newspaper. And then for George, who's Atlas, I wanted somebody who was religious because I needed a soul for this group. And I needed somebody who, when the other sidekicks were looking at the destruction of the city during their strike because they're not helping, I needed somebody who would be able to say, hey, maybe this isn't the right thing. You know, is all of this destruction and harm worth what we're going to get out of it? So I liked the idea of having somebody who was deeply religious and spiritual. And for that, having a Catholic who was also Hispanic, Latinx, that it made so much sense for the story. So while I was trying to have good representation in the book, I also wanted that representation to assist the story and not just feel like pandering or tokenism.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other thing I was really intrigued by was the use of the fact that not everybody has turned the corner when it comes to believing in the sidekicks. There's a discussion between two characters at that burger world where one of them is saying that she still doesn't trust them. So they still have, you know, ground to gain as far as the public goes.
Right. So they did buy. There are some people in the sidekick world who are going to blame the sidekicks for the bad things that happened as a result of the strike. Just like there are people in our world when teachers go on strike and, you know, the kids aren't in school, people blame the teachers instead of blaming the school district. So that's what I was trying to bring a little bit to this book. And the manager of the burger world she's just very cynical, you know, and she was like that in the first four issues. Whenever she was on the page, she was always very cynical of what the sidekicks were trying to do. And then now in the new issues of the new story, she is still very cynical, even though there are other people. I mentioned at the newspaper that public opinion is actually pretty good for the new team that the sidekicks have put together. But the manager of the burger world is still very cynical about them. And she brushes off their achievements, saying, you know, they really haven't defeated any real bad guys since the board of directors, who were the main villains in the last arc. And I liked having that kind of, I didn't want everybody to just hop on board because I don't think that's realistic. If sidekicks were real in a world where superheroes were real and they went on strike and allowed a major US city to get relatively destroyed, I don't think people would be that easy to forgive them. So I did want to make sure I had that viewpoint included.
Since that was great because it gave me, like you said, a realistic feel that this isn't necessarily, you know, DC, everybody seems to believe in the superheroes. Marvel's the other way. They don't believe in the heroes and things very much. So to see that balance and that diversity, even in the opinions of the people, I thought was really nice writing because I forget that I'm reading a comic when I get into that. I sort of enter the world and I listen to these people and I'm like, I'm standing next to them hearing this, you know, very different set of opinions going against each other. So I really thought that was nice writing. I really liked that.
Thank you.
That's good stuff. Now, the other thing we got to get to, and it's a very important part of the story, are the aliens. There were no aliens in the initial arc. In this one, there are. We talked about them before, and I'm really fascinated. The one thing you told me last time I kept thinking about when I was reading is that you know what the aliens are actually saying, even though we can't read it right now. And you and I were talking before we started to record about the fact that the letterer put in certain words that are in there. So if I was a linguist and I was able to figure it out, I could probably sort out what it is they're saying to each other. But
right. Yeah. The letterer is HDE, who's been with me since the first issue. He is absolutely fantastic. And when I sent him the script, the dialogue for the aliens is in English. I wrote it in English so that I would know what they were saying. So my artist would know what they were saying so that he could better have either, their body positioning, their posture, or their facial expressions mirror what the dialogue is, because we knew that we were going to change it so that the reader would not be able to, that it was going to be in this alien language. And what my letterer was able to do was create a 26 character alien alphabet and then just do a very simple substitution. So, there's the letter A in English corresponds to whatever this character is that stands for A in the alien language. And if somebody were so inclined, and I'm not suggesting anybody actually do this, but if they were so inclined, they could go and take a look at all of the dialogue that the aliens speak and work out what they're saying in English. Because that's how I wrote it in the script, and I did want it to be that way. I'm reminded, I used to love doing I think they're called cryptograms or cryptographs, which letters, it's the same kind of thing where there's letters, but they're all, every letter represents a different letter of the alphabet. And there's like a sentence or two, and you're supposed to go and try to figure out what all of the letters actually mean so you can read the actual sentence. And that was kind of what I wanted to be able to do with the language of the aliens in this book.
This is cool. I love when people, think that far ahead and have all this sorted out. And my understanding is at some point we will begin to understand what they're actually saying.
Yes, I will eventually introduce a linguist, somebody whose superpower is languages. And it is going to be this character who is kind of the breakthrough because right now as it stands, because the aliens don't speak English and our superheroes can't understand what they're saying, they don't know what they want. It's just all of a sudden the aliens appear in the genetics laboratory. There are 7 hostages inside the building, and we don't know what they're there for. But, we don't know what the aliens want. We don't know why they're here. And so because now finally, because of this linguist, we can start to unravel that particular mystery and work towards a resolution.
That'd be fun. I'm looking forward to that tremendously. Now, I've got to talk about 2 other things, at least. The introduction of the female characters, doing them so realistic, one of the great things that you do is there are 2 kissing sequences in this book, and I won't go into more than that, but I got a huge kick out of that because that's quite a change from the first arc, and they're done even kind of comically along the way, I have to say. Really human again, very human characters and doing that. So that stood out to me as quite a change in the book from the first arc.
For people who have not read the book, the very first page of the very first issue is our main character, Richard, who's the superhero Phantasm, or the superhero sidekick, I should say. And he is crying. It's a super close up on his face, tears streaming out of his eyes, and he's got a gun in his mouth. And he is contemplating suicide. That was one of the very first images I ever had for the book when I sat down to start writing it. And I just loved that visual because it immediately says to the reader, hey, here's what's going on with this guy. And don't you want to turn the page and find out what happens? So, you know, that kind of darkness starting the first arc, the first storyline, and then starting the second storyline, the very first page of the fifth issue, is Richard and his ex-fiance, Emily, just in this close-up, lip-locked kiss. I just really liked the difference from that page, you know, the original page to the new page, and just to see, oh, okay, before he was so upset because Emily was leaving him, and now they're kissing. You know, just the disparity between those two images tickled me. I love playing with mirror images in this book and in this series and in my writing in particular. For the first two issues, there's a four-page sequence in the first issue, which is an action sequence between Mr. Marvelous and Phantasm, his sidekick, where Mr. Marvelous is fighting a bad guy, and as a result, there's debris falling from the building that's going to fall onto people on the street. So Phantasm is down there protecting the people, making sure they're not getting hurt. And then in the second issue, I have a very similar four-page sequence where Mr. Marvelous is fighting a bad guy, but this time Phantasm's not there because the sidekicks are on strike. And as a result, civilians are getting injured. So I went into writing that very specifically to mirror the original four pages in the first issue with those four pages in the second issue. And I'm constantly looking for ways to do that, where I have a sequence in one part of the book where I can do a reference to it in another part of the book. And that's why I went with that splash opening of Richard and Emily kissing at the beginning of issue 5 was very much to mirror what was happening on the first issue of issue 1, on the first page of issue 1.
Yeah, very cool. I really like it. And again, it's very human, which I like. The characters always live and breathe when you write them to me. It's like I'm watching a transcript of something that really happened. And I like that. It makes me care about the characters. It's not just a video game where there's punching and kicking and very little else. So I really like that. However, you did bring up the thing that I wanted to make sure I got in, and that is the action sequences. I thought they were really well done. So good when that happens. You know, it's not just the dialogue. There are things happening, super heroic things. And I thought that was really well done. Very accurate. My understanding of how superheroism should run, you know, if it were real. And so for me, I really liked that. And I thought the artwork really displayed that as well. So I enjoyed that because superhero books, you know, action is a very important part of the whole formula. So I liked that quite a lot. And I thought you've gotten really good with that. I bet if you took over another comics era, a big three or something like that, I think you'd be able to do a superhero book superbly.
Thank you. The irony there is action is my least favorite thing to write because I really do approach the action in the book as if it's a real fight. And that's a problem when you're dealing with superheroes because they're so powerful. You know, like when one character can run at, you know, super speeds at nearly the speed of light, that's an unstoppable character at that point. You know, nearly. You really have to get creative to figure out how to either slow that character down or find a way to stop them. Otherwise, they can just take out all of the bad guys in a snap of the finger and then you're done. And so I always approach my action sequences with, okay, what would realistically happen if people have these powers? And how can I level the playing field so that if I do have a very powerful character, I can slow them down a little bit? So, for example, in this issue, in chapter 6, one of the bad guys has super speed, which counters the fact that one of the superheroes also has super speed. So that's no longer, you know, they counter each other out at that point. You know, neither one of them can use that super speed to overpower the others in the group, because they're going to be moving at the same pace. And so that gave it some balance. And then with the aliens, because we really don't know what their powers are, I gave them a lot of technology to play with, and because of that, there was a lot of taking people by surprise. You know, that's how we're going to level the playing field. Is there's going to be a moment in the beginning of an action sequence where just one person does not know what's coming, and as a result, I can take them off the playing field for a couple of panels to let others get into the fight and, you know, get to a stalemate. That was always the trick for me, was figuring out how to keep everybody balanced. And Andre Portilla, who is my penciler on the book for these current issues, really, I thought, did just a phenomenal job taking the action that I put in the script and portraying it on the page, because it's really not easy. I give a lot of credit. I can't draw stick figures. So for an artist to come in and take a look at the action that in on the written page, but then being able to translate that into a moment in time. And that's the thing too, is he doesn't have the benefit of being able to draw the action. He has to pick this one moment and convey action. And Andre really just did a phenomenal job. So I'm glad that you enjoyed it, because I know it's tricky, but trying to get that right really was very, very important.
Well, it's important in a superhero book that there's action happening. You know, the Keith Giffen Justice League, where they joked around and argued with each other and stuff, was a very dramatic book. I always enjoyed that. But, you know, you can't have superheroes without somebody doing some action or doing things. So I think you're getting better and better at it the more you do it. So I think it's great.
Yeah, I do try to balance it. As much as I dislike writing the action, I do try to balance between having, you know, showing the action on the page, but then also showing some downtime, because that's precisely because of what you said. You know, when people are reading a superhero book, there is an expectation that there is going to be these action sequences. And frankly, this would be a very difficult story to tell if there wasn't any action. You know, aliens take hostages in the genetics laboratory, so the superheroes show up and have coffee with them. I don't even know what that story would look like.
Well, there's some writers that would do that. I wouldn't read it, but some would. I wanted to mention too, I love the names of a lot of the characters, and there's one who gets a lot of ridicule for his name, and that's Captain Celebrity. And I got a kick. Go ahead.
It's Celerity.
Celerity. Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. That is a very, very common mistake. And I don't know if it's because people are just reading it too quickly. And it's not a common word. And literally the only reason I even know that word exists is because in college I was part of a Vampire the Masquerade LARP. And one of the superpowers that the vampires can have in that game is celerity, which is super speed. That's the only reason I even know that word exists. And it's what's funny is when I named the character that, my editor said to me, he was like, "Are you really sure you want to name a character Celerity?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know, people are going to have to get out a dictionary for that." I go, I don't mind making my audience work. And I think that's something that I will never apologize for. I will never apologize for making a reader go do a little bit of work to figure out what's happening in my story. Because I used to have to do that. You know, I grew up on Claremont's X-Men, And there was vocabulary that was beyond, you know, what eighth grade me was able to understand. There were themes that were mature beyond what I was at that time. And the same thing with like with the mysteries. I don't mind throwing in a mystery and making the reader work a little bit for it. I have no problem doing that, because if you're going to read a book, you shouldn't, it should be an experience. It should not be, I pick it up, I flip through the pages, and then 5 minutes later, I put it down and move on to the next thing. You know, I have no problem with a reader really having to pause and say, oh, wait a minute, how does this make sense? Oh, okay, now I see.
Well, this book has a lot of balance to it. You know, it's a great superhero book, but it's got great characters and great drama going on. And you know, on many levels, this works. And it's been that way since the start. I'm just a huge fan of this book. And Sidekicked is one of those books. If you haven't supported the Kickstarter already, I highly recommend. It's Side-Kicked when you look out there. And so be sure to do that. You can catch up. One of the great things that you have out here is the ability to catch up with, I think, is it digital and physical?
Yes.
Okay. So that's good. So you're going to do that. If you haven't heard of it, I highly recommend, because it's one of those books that, you know, everybody always says superheroes, you can't do anything new or different with them. But you disprove that with this book. There's a lot to be done. And you are doing a great deal of storytelling that I haven't seen before. And I really like that with my years of reading. Somewhere new is just a great experience for me. And that's why I really love this book. And I've always liked Sidekicks too. And their evolution is fun to read and to watch. And I think you and the artist have got this great, I don't know what the word is, but this, I want to say symmetry, but the two of you work together. And it really just feels like a natural expression of the two of you into this one voice that makes it a great read.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's always tricky working with a new artist, because the first issue was drawn by Miguel Mendoza, who unfortunately had to leave because he started getting a ton of work at DC. He's currently drawing Aquaman for anybody who's reading Aquaman. Just Miguel is crushing it there. Bong Dezo finished the series for me. He did issues 2 through 4. He passed away, I want to say 2 years ago now. So he, you know, obviously could not come back to do the book. And so I put the call out, you know, I'm looking for a new artist. And Andre Portilla's work just jumped out at me. And it was pretty clear. I mean, there was a lot of really good talent that sent in their portfolios to me, but Andre's really stood out above the rest. I 100% see him drawing for either Marvel or DC within the next 5 years. And my only hope is we can get the next 3 issues done before that happens.
Well, you know, you as a storyteller, you just know when you see the art that works with your story. It just jumps out on you. I don't know if you can even identify exactly, you know, what it is about the art that really works, and you may be able. Was there some specific thing about the talent, about what he did that attracted you to it?
It was the portfolio pages he sent me were Spider-Man pages that he did. And I think it was like an 8-page sequence. And what really stood out to me, aside from the fact that he's just a really good artist, was his ability to tell the story. Because there's no words on the penciled pages that he sent. And I was able to follow. I was able to go, okay, I know exactly what is happening in every single one of these panels. And I'm able to follow the story through the entire 8-page sequence. And some people are great artists, but they cannot tell a story with their art. And Andre could. And it just, that's what jumped out at me more than anything else.
I always judge an artist by facial expressions and by action sequences. And both of his on those levels really work, really strong. You know, I have to say, though, you've done a great job of coordinating all these different artists. I didn't really notice the change of artist. The style is so consistent from, you know, from the first issue forward. And I think you've done a great job of picking the artists that can do that so well. So I honestly didn't really notice that. I don't pay attention to that so much. If the art works, it works. And so, you know, I think you did a great job of making all these things work.
And I did. I looked for a specific style. You know, once Miguel had that first issue done, you know, everybody after that, I was looking for something similar. And while there, you know, I can see, you know, pretty clearly the distinctions between Bong's work and Miguel's work and Andre's work versus Bong and Miguel. But they're all, they rhyme. You know, if that makes sense, you know, their work rhymes, and I was able to spot that, and it was one of the reasons why I picked both of them to work on the series.
Mm-hmm. Well, did a good job with that. Really great. The stuff really works. And so there's 5 issues in the second arc, right?
Right. Yeah. So the first story, which is collected in a trade paperback published by Darby Pop Publishing, is issues 1 through 4. And then issues 5 through 9 is going to be the second arc. And chapter 5 was released last year. And now this Kickstarter is for chapter 6.
Are they through Darby Pop still?
No, the new issues are not under contract. And I'm going to throw in the yet, because the whole reason why I came back to Sidekicked was because the trade paperback was selling very, very well. We're into the third printing now. Wow. of the trade. So, but Darby Pop only, because they publish with creator-owned series, and they have kind of shied away from doing single issues. They're only doing collected editions. That's what I need to have to present to them for publishing. So while I assume there's going to be interest, because, you know, I have talked to Jeff Klein over at Darby Pop, you know, about the sequel. The sequel is not under contract at this time. But once all 5 issues are finished, then I'll have something that I can present to them that they can then collect into a trade that they will be able to publish. So clearly that's the first place I go. I would anticipate that they're going to be on board just based on the relationship that I have with them. But you never know, you know, things can happen between now and the time that the book is done, but that is currently the plan, is, continue to use Kickstarter for funding for these next, 3 issues after this one. And then once all of the 5 are done, to pitch it to Darby Pop for publishing.
Well, it sounds good. I'm very optimistic that they'll do that, because third printing, really, they got to be glad with that kind of output and interest. So that'll be good. So are there other projects you're working on? Oh, good. Well, let's talk about the Kickstarter, though, before I get to that. As we said, 70% there. You're very likely to get that done. I'm very sure that's going to happen. When does the campaign end?
Friday, August 7th.
Okay, so there's time. But don't wait. Don't make Russell have to sit and read, go to the internet every day and see whether and get that daily heart attack that people do when they look at the Kickstarter. Let's get him past that and get on into stretch goals and good things so we can do that. I got to get me a trade of that initial run. I've gotten the individual issues, I think. I think Darby Pop put them out at that time, didn't they?
Nope, all of the single issues were done through self-publishing, which actually makes them incredibly rare, because I think the print run for each of them was less than 400.
Wow. I'd still like to have the trade. I'm going to go after that. They still sell that through Darby Pop, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can actually get it through the Kickstarter, too.
Oh, maybe I'll do that. I can up my level. I did up my pledge, by the way. I was just going to get a digital, and I thought, you know, there's a much better level than just that. So my pleasure. I had to go back and even more revise it so I can get that. I'd like to have that because this is a great book. If you haven't read Sidekicked, I have to, again, recommend it to you. And go to Kickstarter, look to Side-Kicked. I'm always afraid people are going to leave that hyphen out and not get to it. And the actual title, as it is, it's Sidekicked Chapters 1-6, Heroes, Sidekicks, Aliens, and More. So it's a very great book. I loved it ever since the first time I came across this. And we've talked several times. And we need to talk again when things continue to move forward. So I'm very optimistic you're going to get there. And we're going to get to see more Sidekicked. And so, again, go there and give Russell easy the rest of the way through the Kickstarter project, and you'll really get a good book as a result of it. So, you know, Russell, as always, keep it up. You do wonderful stuff as far as those goes. And I did want to ask, are there other projects you're going on right now?
So I'm such a slow writer, my notebook of ideas. I'm sure most writers have one of these. Probably a lot of non-writers have one of these as well, which is just it's a bunch of springboards. And then from every once in a while, I will be looking at the springboard and just an idea will come for a story in there. So I've got a notebook that's literally filled with just pages and pages of parts of a story. And I find it difficult to multitask. So while Sidekicked is being created, I find it hard to concentrate on another project. But probably the one that I have put the most work into, the script that I have worked on the most that is not Sidekicked, is called Galahad Degraded, which is about, again, it's a superhero-esque story about an aged superhero who went by the moniker Galahad. And finally, he reached his breaking point and wound up murdering his arch nemesis. And he is, you know, he turns himself into the police and he's incarcerated. But once the criminal element of the city realizes that he is behind bars, crime just skyrockets in that city. And the police chief and the mayor kind of hatch this plan where they will get Galahad to train rookie officers in his methods. Not so much the vigilantism, but in, you know, his fighting style and in his just ability to track down where the bad guys are, really the psychology of a criminal, really. And so the story becomes about him while in prison training these young cops. And one of them, who's kind of his star protege, starts to cross the line. And so that's really the bulk of that story.
Wow.
And that's probably the next thing. Once Sidekicked is done, that's the one that I'm really going to be jumping into full throttle.
So is this second arc the final arc?
I don't ever like to say final. Whenever I approach a book, I always want to make sure that I end it on a final note. Like, I really want the end to be a legitimate end so that if there are not more, the audience isn't saying, well, what happens next? You know, I never want to be in a situation where I'm telling a story and I leave a major cliffhanger and then we never come back to it. You know, kind of like watching the first season of a TV show and it ends on a big cliffhanger, and then there's no second season. I never, ever want to do that to my audience. So when I came, you know, so with the first four issues, that is a story in itself. You know, the main conflict is the strike, and I resolve it by the end of the fourth issue. But I also pepper in a couple of story elements that we can continue with. So, for example, the sidekicks who are the villains in the first four issues, I give them enough story so that even though we reach the end of the main story, their story can continue, which is what I'm doing now in the new series as well. So this next arc, the five issues, I approach it as a complete story. So when we get to chapter nine and we get to the end, it's done. But hopefully I've peppered in enough of the world that if I were to return to Sidekicked in the future, there's still more story to tell. So I absolutely look at it as an end point, but I also like to make sure that I leave enough, you know, meat, so to speak, to continue if that's the case. But probably once I'm done with Sidekicked, I will do a different book just to kind of, you know, flex my writing muscles a little bit outside of that world. I don't want to ever get too comfortable writing it. You're just in the Sidekicked world. I would like to branch out a little bit. So, it, you know, Sidekicked 3, let's say, is not going to be the next project, but it absolutely could happen at some point in the future.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that because I'm enjoying this book. Like I said, from the start, I've been addicted to this series, so I can't wait to see that. I would like to see other stuff you're writing. That would be great fun to do, to see. So it's Get Sidekicked, chapters 1 through 6, : Heroes, Sidekicks, Aliens, and More. So there's lots going on in that. And again, it concludes on Friday, August 7, 11:59 EDT. So it's getting 70% in, but that's no reason to rest on the laurels. We got to make sure we get over the $3,000 goal to make sure it happens. So Russell, again, just keep it up. It's wonderful stuff. I can't wait to read more on this. And I'm so fortunate I got a chance to read this issue. So again, people, if you haven't, you know, pledged for this, be sure to get out there and do that because it's so worth it.
Hey, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Great to welcome to the program Rob Stanley, the creator of a very fascinating book, one I really like, called The Bite of Brenna Barlow. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you. And two things we need to do right away. You've got a Kickstarter going on, and there's congratulations to be had. You've actually met your goal already, which is great. So that's a good thing to do. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to have reached my goal to the point where, like, the next 10 days are going to be just, you know, smooth sailing, trying to push the current stretch goal, which is a PDF of an origin story that will lead into the next book. But it's just nice to take some of the stress out of it and just promote it with worrying about it not reaching as high as I'd like it to reach.
Yeah, the old daily heart attack, as I like to call it. People log on, and you worry. Have they stopped? Is it over? Well, no, that's good. You've gotten quite successful, and that's good. Second thing I wanted to mention was the fact that you mentioned on Facebook that you listen to the podcast, and I'm always a little surprised. I've done so many episodes, and I've only a couple of times run into people who listen to it, so I appreciate the kind words you said out on Facebook.
any time, Wayne. I like anything that helps creator-owned comics, creator-owned writers and artists get their stories and books out there. I mean, anything that gets us noticed is something that not only I appreciate, but I respect. And you've had a wide array of people on your podcast. So when I saw the wide variety of genres and writers and artists that you covered, I just had to contact you and see if you'd have me on your show.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm getting that several times these days. The folks approach me through Facebook, and I always appreciate that when they do. And so likewise with you, I greatly appreciated that you brought this to my attention. So let's dive in and talk a little bit about this. As far as vampires go, I'm sure that your story has something new to bring to the vampire lore. Talk about what you think that is, what it is you bring to the vampires.
Well, in most vampire stories, either they're like the dark, brooding, you know, body in the shadows or a villain or something like that. When I introduced Brenna, I introduced her in one of Tim West's Hollow Scream anthology books back in 2018. Her story came from a written short story that I just had laying around on my flash drive called He Said, She Said. I figured I'd try to flesh it out for a story, and it came out really well. It was a little bit darker and more straightforward in horror than what you see right now, because when I decided to try to turn it into a book, I knew that there had to be some levity, maybe some comic relief, some dark humor, and that's where you see, if you click on my Kickstarter, you see that Brenna has a dachshund, a dog named Gary, who is basically her sidekick. And Brenna, of course, is a sightless vampire who has a sixth sense, meaning she can read people's minds, and she can actually communicate with her dog through this telepathy too.
Mm-hmm. Which is what I like. I'm a big dog fan, and I love the way that he does it. He's got kind of a sarcastic edge to him. Was he patterned after any dog you know, or you know, what kind of things you think a dog might think?
Well, my wife and I, when we were still dating, we got a dog named Gary. Long-haired dachshund, and he was basically our first kid, and he lived about 12 years, and he just had that personality about where he looked at you a certain way, and you could have a feeling that he was thinking something. And I actually started writing this while Gary was still with us. He passed away 2 years ago, and it's just nice to know that he'll live on through these books that I write, and people seem to really, really like having like the dog sidekick in the book, which I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, it's really kind of cute. Right on the cover, he's got a funny saying on there. He's sitting there in her lap, obviously, and he says, "Jason Momoa, eat your heart out."
Yeah. That look that he has there was taken from one of actual Gary's photos. When I had Greg, my cover artist, do that, I sent him a picture of Gary. I said, "Try to make that as accurate as you can." He did a bang-up job.
That's kind of cool. Does the artist internally, you gave him pictures to use as guides for the character?
Well, for the character, yes. When I pictured her, I wanted her to be the opposite of what you would imagine a female vampire to be. I didn't want her to look like, you know, dark hair, dark makeup. I said, you know, blondes usually in most things are innocuous, you know, there's a blonde joke. I wanted this blonde to kick butt. And what sprung to mind first when I was writing Brenna in the initial script for this first issue, I was thinking of, there's an actress on a British soap opera that I watch called Hollyoaks, and she's no longer on the show. She's actually coming back in October. Her name's Georgie Porter, and Georgie Porter is the complete package of being this pretty actress, but in the show she kicks a lot of butt too, and she's very spunky, and that's the R I wanted to give Brenna.
Cool, very cool. So, very strong character, and as you know, listening to the podcast, the lead females who are strong always appeal to me. So the moment I saw that, I was drawn to the book, and I always ask, and usually people tell me that it just kind of felt that's what should be done. But why have a strong female lead instead of a male, which, of course, comics are famous for?
Well, in this initial issue, we delve into Brenna's backstory. I mean, she's a vampire, so she's been around for some time. She's 144 years old. And some of the things that are revealed about her, some of the things that made her what she is today, some sadness, some despair, some loss, it wouldn't have been as effective if it was a male character. These are things that could have only happened to a female. So it kind of all came together in like a puzzle piece sort of way, that it all just kind of worked that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it starts out, there's a great sequence where she's basically like a service rep on a telephone, and she's responding to the people on the phone, and there's great lines. We don't ever hear what they say, but we can tell what it was they're talking about when she responds to them. Is that based on something that you went through, or is that the way you kind of imagine sometimes these folks on the phones have to deal with people?
Well, in my day job, I work customer service. Mm-hmm. I work in a money center at a local Walmart. Mm-hmm. Shout out to store 1623. And we see a lot of different things throughout the course of the day. I mean, things that if someone just came up to you and said, this is what happened at my work, you would look at them and say, you just have a great imagination, or you're trying to pull my leg. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to give her like a job, a night job. I thought, well, customer service, let's see what kind of out there. Some of the different things that she says there to the customers are some of the things that I've had to deal with on the job where I work.
Mm-hmm. Funny. I mean, that obviously has a ring to real of it. So that's kind of fun to do. Kind of interesting that she's telepathic, but can she tell what they're actually saying or thinking over the phone?
Well, throughout the course of the book, you'll see that for the most part, her telepathic powers kind of hone to different things. Like, she can't just look at someone and say, oh, what are they thinking? She kind of picks up on little things. Usually, someone's in despair, or someone's about to do something that they're not supposed to do, and she springs into action.
Because at the very beginning, she's got a coworker that she kind of vibes into.
Yes.
Talk about her. I mean, what's the situation with her?
The coworker has a bit of a problem at home, and not only through the telepathic powers, but just through conversation, Brenna picks up on what her problems are at home. But in the long run, she concludes, and this is something she concludes to quite often, there's some people who just have to help themselves, and that kind of plays into the story later on.
And then later on, she basically picks up a thought from somebody else. Talk about that. I mean, what is the extent of her telepathic abilities?
It's more or less like her mind is almost like the bat signal. Like someone might be within shouting distance or across town, and she can feel them, hear their thoughts in her mind, and she'll do what she can to get to that person. In this initial story, there is someone who is in despair, who really, really cannot help themselves, mm-hmm. and needs Brenna immediately, and she seeks that person out the best she can, and that's the basis of the story in this initial issue.
It's fun to have the dog kind of making comments to her, and we can actually hear what the dog is thinking. I always remember there's a book from Aftershock in which suddenly the animals become sentient, and we get to hear what they think and say, and we get a little bit of that sense in here with the dog. It's kind of fun. He's actually quite a funny character for a dog.
I really enjoy writing Gary. I really enjoy writing their relationship. I mean, they care about each other. Obviously, he's a little dachshund. He can't really do much, but he does what he can to protect Brenna. And actually, one of the rewards in the Kickstarter is a PDF of a short that I wrote. This isn't a stretch goal. This is one that you can actually select in the Kickstarter, where it's called Confessions of a Long-Haired Dachshund. And it's a PDF of where you see how Brenna and Gary met.
Oh. Is it a comic or just a written story?
No, it is a comic short. I believe it's 4 to 6 pages. I can't remember offhand. And you see where Brenna and Gary first met and how their relationship got to this point leading into the book.
Mm-hmm. Which is great fun. I really enjoy the action and I enjoy the character, getting to know her a little bit. And, you know, I would say if people were telepathic, they wouldn't be quite as good to people as she is. I mean, I've been watching Stargirl, and they have, like, Brainwave and Brainwave Jr. on there. And Jr. is the one that seems to be the nicer of the bunch, but his powers are just coming out. But the father has listened to other people's thoughts and gotten really jaded towards people. But that hasn't happened with her.
No, she, like, in the initial short that I wrote with her, she wanted to be different from her kind. And in being different from her kind, she wanted to use her powers, not only telepathic powers, but being a vampire, to help those who can't help themselves, or those who are too weak, or those who just have no voice. She wants to help.
Well, that's cool. Now, you're saying that she's different from most of the other vampires around her. Is that, I mean, how different is she? Is she really unlike all the other vampires?
Well, in a way, she has a heart. She, you know, I mean, granted, she is a vampire. She does vampire things. She does feast on the blood, on people. And if she's treated right, she treats others right. But, like, I was just actually editing the second issue script before I spoke to you today. And she has relationships with other non-vampire humans where she cares about them and they care about her. And she doesn't see them as a source for her lifeblood.
So where does she get blood from then?
I mean, you don't really see it in this one, but she could be out in the wild. I mean, some of the ne'er-do-wells that she stumbles upon when she's helping others, sometimes they wind up being a snack.
Interesting. So she doesn't what she needs to survive.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a good thing about that. It's fun. What's interesting is she comes across the person she's there to help is a younger character. And yeah, she's very sympathetic, which I really like. You know, honestly, it's nice to see a vampire who is helpful like that. She finds a way to help the young girl and quite nice about it. And, of course, along the way, Trouble meets them, and we get to see how she likes to kick ass. How was that to write the action sequences and, you know, the battles, particularly between her and the people who get in her way?
They were the hardest panels to write. I had to probably edit them more so than anything else in the script just because I wanted them to flow. I didn't want it to just look like one big just jumbled mess. I wanted to go boom, 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 like something as if you were watching an action movie or a sequence in a television show. And I was quite pleased with how it turned out.
What's interesting is, you know, we're talking about something that's a big reveal, actually, about halfway through the comic, that her being a vampire, when she bares her fangs really for the first time, it's quite a shock to me. I figured she was just a telepath, although, you know, the name of the book kind of gives away a little of that. Was that on purpose? I mean, did you want to set up her character before you confirm at least that she's a vampire?
Yeah, I didn't want her to just be some stereotypical Fright Night sort of vampire, just looking scary. And just I wanted them to see the compassionate, the sympathetic part of her. As you see in the book, there's some flashbacks to her life, you know, especially when she comes upon the young girl. And I just wanted to see the human side of her before she just went full-born, bared her fangs, and just, you know, kicked everyone's ass.
Because when she takes on these three people, let's just say they don't stand up all that well to her.
No, she, in the right scenario, she is almost like a rabid pit bull, and she just can take anyone, and unless you catch her off guard, Brenna could probably take pretty much anyone on, especially if they underestimate her.
Now, what's funny is when things get done and the young girl's with her, she asks what happened, and her response I thought was quite funny. I don't want to reveal that unless you feel that's okay to do, but her response is quite humorous.
I know what you're talking about, and, you know, I have a great support base with family and friends, and I share my scripts with them best I can. And it seems like that line from that first book is the favorite part of a lot of people that I know. It just fit well. It was almost like a wisecrack in like a Steven Seagal or Dirty Harry, like an Eastwood movie, where it just fit perfectly.
Yeah, it's a funny line. We won't spoil it here, but I can tell you is when you get to the end of the battle, be sure to read the dialogue. It's going to be very good. It's going to be good stuff. So then, of course, she moves on, and she kind of resolves the situation with the young girl very nicely. And then, of course, when the young girl's going away and she's with an adult, there's a follow-up question to the funny line, which is a great line. So that's nice writing. I like when you introduce something and then follow it up later on. Great stuff.
Yeah.
And then we get another flashback for her, which I enjoy. And now, something interesting to me, this all takes place in Townington, Maryland.
In most of my books, I create a fictional town in Maryland. I mean, I'm from Pennsylvania, but I have family in Maryland. I have friends in Maryland. Maryland kind of holds a special place in my heart. So I wanted to create my own little fictional town that I could, you know, and you see Brenna starts in there. But then in the flashbacks, you see that actually Brenna hails from a small town in England called Houghtonley Spring. And that I came upon that town just simply doing ancestry searches before my son was born to see different, you know, I wanted to compile something for him 7 years ago. And I noticed that on my father's side, and this was, I got a kick out of this because I love British TV. I love pretty much anything to do with England. I have ancestry that comes from this small village, small town, what have you, of Houghtonley Spring. And I just wanted to throw a little bit of that in there into the book.
Cool. Now, does she have an accent when she speaks then?
She has an accent. You'll see little bits and pieces where she's like, oh, bugger or bloody. Or I try to make the dialogue. I didn't want it to come all like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins sort of way. I wanted it to be authentic, just, you know, not stereotypical. So through watching some of the shows I watch, there's some lingo, some dialogue that I throw in there. In the initial short story, I can't remember what the scenario, but she says to the man who she stumbles upon in the bar, she goes, oh, well done, you. And that's kind of like slang over there in the UK. Mm-hmm. Like, well, good job, well done, you. So I try to make it as authentic without going over the top, because the last thing I want our readers to come to me and say, hey, you're doing the Dick Van Dyke with Brenna.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that you mentioned, I think, and I didn't follow up on it at the time, but I think we need to talk some more about, is the fact that she's blind. That was a surprise to me.
She was born blind, and she makes the best out of it, and she uses her sixth sense and just her other senses to make it through the day, to make it through life, and she does a bang-up job doing it.
That's amazing, because a lot of the times I kind of forget that she is blind, because she does so many things, and she moves, you know, quite well. Without that,
well, I kind of do like the bat aspect. Like, you know how bats have sonar? Bats can kind of, that's kind of like how she is. And again, I didn't want to do a stereotypical flying. You know, you could see that her eyes are sightless. She does occasionally have the guide cane. And as I'm writing in the second script, sometimes Gary does don the service animal vest. Mm. But she mostly takes care of herself, and she's a person, and she's not a blind person.
So she was born blind, you said?
Yes, yes, she was born blind. It's not drawn into the story there, but in her backstory, eventually, she was born blind. That's something she's always dealt with. She's been blind longer than she's been a vampire.
Wow. Okay, now you raised something I got to follow up on. How did she become a vampire? Is that something we're going to get a flashback about eventually?
Well, it's alluded to a little bit in the book, the first book, where the father doesn't speak too kindly about her mother and doesn't want what's going on, doesn't want the situation. I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but doesn't want something to become just like her mother. Mm-hmm. And that kind of little foreshadowing of what we might find out later on about how Brenna became a vampire.
Now, one of the interesting things about the book, remember we talked about the co-worker. we also get something of a resolution to that story in the end of the book, which I kind of enjoyed. Yes. That was nicely written, I have to say. I liked the fact that we kind of left that for a while and then we came back to it. So that's quite a fun. And it resolves itself interestingly. And, of course, through her, we get to hear what the co-worker's thinking, which was something.
Yes.
I like that. Was that – I mean, what was the inspiration for that? Is that – I mean, did you happen to know somebody who was going through a similar situation?
I've known people who've gone through that and who've made it through that sort of situation. And also in that I wanted to, you know, in a lot of comics you see the big superhero or anti-hero, what have you, save the person in peril. And, I mean, you do see that in a way in this book. But I also wanted to see, as Brenna puts it at some point in the book, that sometimes the situations work themselves out and people take care of themselves and they get themselves out of trouble themselves, and they don't need her.
Which I'm sure she's happy to find. I mean, she'd probably rather not get involved. So it's pretty good. Very cool. So I'm fascinated with her because, you know, as long-lived as she is, and she kind of alluded, you mentioned, we talked about turning into bats and stuff like that, and I gather from what you said, that's not part of her.
No.
Okay. That's kind of standard vampire stuff, and you know everybody's done that. So,
yes.
I like what you're doing. You're making a more human vampire, and not in the way that many of them do. You know, like a lot of the vampire stories. Let's just say there's a lot of sexual stuff going on with, and you hint a little at something sexual in this book. But it's not like Interview with a Vampire or something like that.
And I mean, it's not like Brenna's going to be sexless. I mean, in the second book, and even in, as I was telling you earlier about the stretch goal where you get a PDF of a short that kind of leads into the second book, Brenna has love once in her life. And she has experienced love before. So she's not some just robotic vampire going around helping others and not feeling love in her heart. She has felt love in her heart, and that will be touched upon well at some point.
So that's going to be fun to do. Because it sounds to me like you've got this story like planned out for quite a bit. Do you have a number of issues in mind for this?
I have about three or four. Well, what happened to me back in November was I became very sick and I was off work and I was hospitalized for almost a month. My doctor now thinks I might have had an early strain of COVID-19.
Mm.
And in that, where I couldn't be around my kids and I couldn't be at work, and even when I finally did get home, I couldn't be around my kids because I wasn't strong enough to take care of them. They were either with my parents or my wife's parents. I just wrote. That's what kept me going. I wrote outlines and I fleshed them out. And I have, after this, I want to say like a story arc of three issues that all tie together, and you find out more about Brenna's backstory, about some of the people that she knew in the past, and you even see a little shift in setting, and you get to meet one of Brenna's best friends.
Really? So you do have a lot in mind for her. It's cool that you've fleshed this all out, so to speak.
I did, and I mean, never did I think it would make it this far. I mean, I've seen friends of mine, established creators like Garrett Gunn, Stephanie Menard, Alan Evans, who did Kickstarters, numerous ones, and did well, but I don't have the contacts that they do, so I really had low expectations, and now seeing this well, how well this is doing, and as my friend Josh mentioned, the whole 6 degrees of separation, you know, someone's going to tell their friend and tell their friend, I'm very pleased with where this is going.
Very cool. It's really great. So, I've got the evolution from story to comic. You're saying these people inspired you to go on to make this a comic?
Well, no. I mean, I turned that into a comic when I did the anthology for Tim West's Hollow Scream anthology book.
Okay.
But to pursue a Kickstarter through watching them succeed and through getting tips and just watching them, just through the experience of watching them deal with their Kickstarters, I got the confidence and the experience to do one myself.
So this is your first?
This is my first.
Ooh, wow. You're very fortunate, you have to say. A lot of people that I've run into usually have to do a couple before they figure this whole thing out. I guess your friends kind of, maybe watching them, you learn the right things to do, which is great.
Yeah, a lot of them. And I have a lot of just a good support system who, I mean, like I was telling you earlier, my friend Andrew Dixon, he introduced me to Twitter and taught me how to use Twitter. And ever since I used Twitter, that shot the Kickstarter up a couple $100s. And then just different things, word of mouth, appearing on podcasts like yours and just talking to people like you and getting sharing like about the book like from people like you. It just really has all come together nicely.
Oh, great. Boy, that's a great confluence of things, because, you know, you're really fortunate, I have to say. It's great that it's happened this way for you, because I've run into a lot of people who have struggled with Kickstarters, which I want to go to how you put the book together and how you found the artist and, you know, how you wrote the script and stuff. How did you do that? I mean, did you study how to do this? Internet kind of help? How did you do that?
I mean, I Googled a couple scripts, you know, here and there, but I never fully studied. A lot of what I do, and some of my coworkers could tell you this, I always have some sort of piece of paper or something where I'm working, and if an idea hits me, I'll just jot down random ideas. And then on my lunch or my break, I'll go in the back, I'll be on my laptop, I'll just flesh it out, and I'll probably edit it a couple hundred times after that. I have no procedure of doing it. If an idea hits me, fine. Sometimes an idea will hit me that I might not want to touch upon until later. Like an idea I came upon an idea involving Brenna after this 3-issue story arc that I just kind of have locked away in my laptop bag that I'm not even drawing upon. But when something hits me, I just throw it. It might be an ending that comes. It might be a beginning. It might be a middle. It might even just be a word of dialogue, and I just take it from there.
Cool. Now, how did you find the artist then?
My friend Brian Cole, whom I have had a couple books published through him, through Mobius Media, Lazarus's Eye and Dr. Fizz. I've written some stuff for him where it was mostly, well, in Lazarus's Eye, it was my own book, but Brian initially came to me and had an idea that he wanted fleshed out, and I wrote a script, and that's what became Dr. Fizz. But I asked if he knew anyone, and he suggested J.C. Grant. And Tobin, our letterer, is just someone that I've worked with shorts and different things, because I've done a lot of anthologies, just not my own book on my own like this. And I just think he's one of the best letterers out there. So he and I always, he's my go-to guy when it comes to letters. And that's what happened.
Wow. Well, that's cool. So this isn't your first comic, but it is your first Kickstarter.
It's my first Kickstarter. It's my first comic that all rides on my shoulders. With Lazarus's Eye and Dr. Fizz, it all came down to Brian. It was Brian's thing where it all, if it failed, if it succeeded, it all came down to him. I was just the writer. This, I am the writer. I am the guy who puts it out there. I am the hype man. Telling people about it, it all comes back to me.
Have you thought about putting like a version of this that has those other stories in it?
I've thought about it. My friend Garrett Gunn has the Franklin and Ghost series, and he eventually, after a couple of his books came out, did a hardcover compilation of all the stories and all the different covers and different pinups and whatnot. And I remember when I first got it, my wife said to me, oh, I bet you'd want that for one of your books. And of course I do. And if it ever gets to that point, I would love some kind of compilation like that for Brenna and all the various shorts and different designs and splash pages and whatnot that all came together with this book and this story.
Mm-hmm. Now, did JC do the colors as well?
Actually, a little sad story involving that one. Initially, my colorist was Blake Wilkie, and prior to finishing the pages, he passed away.
Oh.
And at that time, I was trying to get a submission package together to go to a convention and possibly pitch the book to some publishers. Of course, you know that's not even a possibility right now because conventions are getting canceled right and left. That's why I didn't want to wait any longer. I went to Kickstarter, but when Blake passed away, I found this really awesome colorist by the name of Rebecca McConnell. Mm-hmm. and she finished up Blake's pages, and I was able to get everything completed in a nice amount of time.
Oh, great. That's good. So you basically, because I've seen the like an initial draft of it, you've got the first issue basically ready to go.
I do, yes. And it's nice to just look at it, and, you know, I mean, and I have a lot of great pieces of artwork, not only that I'm offering through the Kickstarter, but would be nice pieces of artwork to have at my table whenever conventions start back up. So I have a lot of original Brenna art by Jenny Gorman, Sean Langley from the Rejected, and Benjamin Philby, who's a really great horror artist. And he did a really great mini poster that for the Kickstarter that pays homage to Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm. Really good. So this is going to be good fun. So the first issue is largely done. You said you were working on the script for the second one. Are you going to do another Kickstarter for that one once this is over?
I mean, depending on how well it goes, I mean, I'm trying to space these stories out maybe 4 to 6 months from each other, just so, like, this book can make the rounds. I'm planning after the Kickstarter to put it on Comixology, Indie Planet, wherever I can, where people can get it after the Kickstarter. Make the rounds on Twitter, kind of get it noticed, and then the second book is on a grander scale where, you know, it's you see what Brenna can do in this book. In this one, it's like everything happens. It's like, oh, it the only way I can describe it is like the Great Muppet Caper, where it's like everything happens, everything just comes together, and it's just like it's full balls out just story.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so that'll be good. So it's going to be excellent. Now, it's the same art team?
Actually, because of time constraints, just because I have come to really have a great camaraderie with this man. The gentleman who did the cover that you saw with Gary and Brenna, where he makes the Jason Momoa quip, Greg Waronchak, I hope I pronounced that correctly, he is going to take her as the main artist.
Oh.
He's the artist who has also done the Confessions of a Long-Haired Dachshund, the short I was telling about. Mm-hmm. He and I have worked on other non-Brenna-related shorts or different anthologies, like Russell Nualty's Kalulu is Hard to Spell, The Terrible Twos, the story I did for that, and a couple other different stories. He and I really work well and fire off different ideas well. And J.C. Grant just isn't always available, and Greg is just always there. So I wanted to get like a nice, close-knit team. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to work.
So you're mentioning putting it out digitally. Do you make paper copies and maybe sell it through local shops near you?
I'm going to try. I mean, there are going to be paper copies. I'm going to see what's around here. I mean, unfortunately, I live in a small Pennsylvania town. Mm-hmm. I think the nearest comic shop might be in like an adjacent town, Scranton or something. But I have a great support system, not only here in the States, but here or over in the UK. So once it gets there, I'm going to try to kind of extend my tentacles with the story to different places so people can get a hold of the book and enjoy it.
Okay. You've mentioned my hometown area. That's where I'm from. I'm from a suburb of Scranton originally.
Yes.
So that's kind of cool.
I'm aware of Wayne, but when I mentioned it to my wife, she knew exactly where you were talking about. And
yeah.
It's a small area up here, but it's close-knit. Yeah.
Yeah, the one store I would recommend up that way, Dave Romeo, who does Comics on the Green, Scranton. You might approach him. He's good.
A couple coworkers of mine have mentioned that store, and that is something I'm definitely looking into.
Cool. Very good. So that'll be something I would recommend. But so it's going to be digitally. Comixology? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Okay, so Comixology. That'll be
yes.
Good. There's other ones, too. There's Drive Through Comics and others that you can always approach and do that. It's good because you get the same shelf space that Action Comics gets on the week that you come out.
Yes.
And people can access it and download it and good things like that. So that'd be a good thing to do.
Share the link of being Earth available, too. Like, word of mouth is... We live on die on word of mouth. That's why whenever I know of someone and a creator, or even I see a creator on Facebook or Twitter, and I see that they're starting, you know, we're all in it together. So I do what I can to promote them and make sure they get out there just as well as they helped me get out there too.
I'm kind of interested in that area. Is there a comic book community that's been developing up there?
Well, I mean, there's some coworkers who see me in the break room, and they've seen some of the images of the comic, and they're very curious, and a lot of them have asked me about it, and some of them even have supported the Kickstarter, and they've told different people, and even my wife's one coworker, not only did she support the Kickstarter, but she told her, I believe, her cousin, who's a big comic book fan. So word of mouth is kind of, you know, sprinkling about, so I'm very pleased about that.
Well, also Twitter and stuff. Have you gotten on Facebook?
Facebook I'm more comfortable with. I'm used to that. That's why I made my own artist page. And friends of mine have shared it, and I've put things out there in different groups and everything. There are a lot of different groups. But it seems like I've gotten more traction on Twitter.
Okay. The only thing that worries me about Twitter is that your post goes up, but then like in a minute or two, you're off the page. Because there's so many other people tweeting and stuff, so I like Facebook better myself, but you're right.
Yeah, I like it, but it just seems like I've gotten more I mean, there's some aspects of Facebook, some different, especially when once the book gets out there, some different groups where it probably will work really well just to promote it, but just with the Kickstarter, I've gotten a lot more feedback on Twitter.
That's interesting. Do you perceive there's more comics-related people who are interested on Twitter?
Not only that, there are a lot of creators who are in the same mindset that I am, where they see someone who's coming up who's trying to get a Kickstarter out there, and they support them. And they, whether it's through going on their Kickstarter and pledging, or through sharing and retweeting, or just making a comment or whatever, and that goes a long way.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it, because anything that supports indie comics, I'm for. You know, when I promote this podcast, I use every social media thing I can figure out. Instagram, oh gosh, what are all the ones that I do? I even put it out on LinkedIn and stuff because I want people to be able to, because again, it's promoting the book, not me. So
yeah.
I'm always trying really hard. Tumblr, Pinterest, Mix. All these ones, because I figured them out. There's ones I can't figure out, and so I haven't gotten out there. I've started doing a couple of videos on, what's the name of it? TikTok. And I've done those kinds of things, but I haven't gotten a lot of exposure on there. So, but it's important. I mean, you know, I always talk to creators, and they say half the time you have to spend promoting, and half the time is creating. So it's a different thing.
Yes.
So sadly, you know, like when I talked to Joshua Williamson, he got an exclusive contract at DC, and he said now he can spend 100% of his time creating. He doesn't have to worry because DC's going to give him work, and he knows it.
I really don't mind promoting. Like when I've been involved with different anthologies, like, for example, I mentioned that Cthulhu anthology with Russell and Nowelty. Well, there were a whole bunch of us involved with that. It was Russell's Kickstarter, but I did everything I could to go out there and just be the biggest hype man for the project, no matter where I could talk about it or tell people about it. I don't mind that. I will tell people, and not even just my work. If I know someone who has a book that I really enjoy, like, for example, Garrett Gunn's Franklin and Ghost, and my friend Alan Evans' Rival Angels series, I tell everyone I can because I want them to know how great these products are.
That's kind of similar to this podcast. I'm often promoting stuff that I think people should know more about. If they don't know anything, they should know about it. So that's kind of what the purpose of this whole podcast is for that. And I get to ask questions. I always have a million questions. I'm less of a lecturer and more of a questioner, so for me, like when I get to talk with you, I get to ask you all the questions that I have and, you know, store it up, and I think it helps to do those things. Again, I'm always trying to get people to get more out of their comics, or if they don't know about to find these things. And this book, I think, is going to be one of those ones, you know, you're already a success, and that's always a good thing to have. Again, it's called The Bite of Brenna Barlow. And it's a great book, and you've got obviously a lot of good plans for this character and her dog moving forward. Are there other projects you're working on besides this one, or is this one keeping you busy?
Well, I mean, I have all these scripts kind of, with the exception of the PDF for the stretch goal. That's just outlined. But I have a story that I have written for this year's installment of Tim West's Howl of Scream that Big and I are going to do about a demonic garden gnome. There are different things that I have out there, different, but right now, the first one that I wanted out of the gate, as far as my own books went, I wanted Brenna, because that was like my baby. That's the project that I kind of nurtured and edited 1,000 times just to make sure all the twists and turns and the character development was right. So that's just really the only thing I'm constantly getting that out there, and then getting the rest of the story eventually out there, and just everyone seeing how these characters came to be and where they go, and getting a fan base that'll enjoy it.
Right, and that's the thing, is getting the word out is really critical. So that you do that automatically is a great thing. There are a lot of people I wish would take that and make that happen. So you're already ahead as far as those goes. And I enjoyed the book, you know, the one that I got to read, and I think there's great things to do. Again, it's called The Bite of Brenna Barlow, number one, if you go to Kickstarter. The description says, the heartwarming tale of a telepathic blind vampire and her sarcastic dachshund. Which right away is something different. You know you've never read that before. Yeah. So I like that about that. Well, Rob, I wish you lots of success. You've got a successful Kickstarter under your belt already, and who knows how much farther you're going to get to go with this, and maybe support number two with this.
I'm kind of hoping that. My wife actually mentioned that earlier. I mean, it's going beyond my wildest dreams, and I want to thank everyone who supported and shared, and I want to thank you for having me on the podcast.
Well, it's a great book, and it deserves a lot of support and a lot of interest, and I think you're doing a great job to get that happen. So, Rob, all I can always say is keep it up. You're doing good stuff.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.